Physical and psychological attributes can also be combined for purposes of characterization. As he moved slowly across the room, age and arthritis made him seem brittle, but when he spoke, anywhere, about anything, people stopped to listen as if Moses had come down with new commandments. If you develop a characteristic that's especially pertinent to your character, or original, it's a good idea to use it on the character's first appearance to set the character. For instance, if you know that your character will first be seen walking, then gait is a characteristic that should appear right away. If the character is the kind who always interrupts other people in conversation, you might consider introducing that character as he or she interrupts. For instance, George and Mary were at the kitchen table debating how to handle their misbehaving teenager when Alma walked in and said, "I don't know how you people can just sit there talking instead of getting off your butts and giving that child of yours a lesson with the back of your hand." There are many ways in which characterization can go wrong in the hands of a less experienced writer, but two stand out because they are so common in rejected fiction. There is the protagonist with a weak will and the villain who is merely badly behaved. First, consider the hero who is not heroic, who lacks drive, a will to attain his objective. Let's face it, readers aren't interested in wimps. They are interested in assertive characters who want something, want it badly, and want it now. Test yourself. Would you want to spend 10 or 12 hours with a wimpish character who is weak and ineffectual? Don't ask the reader to. A wimp in life is a social bore. A wimp in fiction is an obstacle to reader enjoyment. I have talked to writers whose problems with wimpish characters in their work had a direct link to their own lives. There are children who, damaged by authority, become fighters against authority. There are also people who, damaged by authority in childhood, become relatively passive adults as a means of camouflaging their aggression and anger to save their hearts and lives. Camouflaged anger is useful in stories, but it is the final unleashing of the anger that attracts readers most. In working with such writers, or with shy writers who produce shy heroes, I have found a way, once they understand the inhospitality of fiction of passivity, to help them get rid of a wimpish protagonist who is de-energizing their fiction. I ask the writer to imagine that he is in his study with the door closed. A person outside wants to come in. The writer orders the intruder to stay out. I ask the writer to imagine a second person outside his door who says to the first, "Get out of my way," then comes into the writer's study without asking. The writer starts to object, and this second intruder says, "You shut up and listen for a change." That second person is the writer's replacement for the wimp. That's his new protagonist. I urge the writer to listen to the character, rude as he is, and then compose a letter from that new non-wimp character to the writer that is assertive, candid, and at least a touch eccentric. As to villains, bad behavior on its own is not as effective as mean-spiritedness, deriving satisfaction and even pleasure from hurting the hero or preventing him from attaining his goal. A section on characterizing villains begins on page 68. In the course of developing a character, there are some questions I will ask myself. Does he behave differently toward strangers than he does to members of his family? Such a difference is revealing. Would my character behave differently when he met an old friend who is now famous, than when he bumped into another friend of the same village who was down on his luck and ashamed? I also ask myself if my character ever talks to people in a way they find offensive. Does he realize he is offending them? Does he try to apologize or change? Or doesn't he care? We know that people reveal themselves more when they raise their voices than when they speak normally. If my character had reason to shout, what would we hear? Or if my character is the kind of person who would never shout, what thought is he repressing? It adds to the drama to have contrast between what the character is doing and what he is saying to himself. As you can see, my questions provoke both good and bad characteristics, and lead me into the character's relationships and into story scenes. When I'm planning a character, I also try to listen to his or her dialogue as if the character were in the room with me. Do they use figures of speech and expressions that characterize strongly? I search for conscious and unconscious mannerisms of my character. As to a character's clothing, and try to focus on one item that will stand out in the reader's mind. For instance, the fact that my character always wears a raincoat, even when the sun is shining. Eventually, I have to ask myself about my character's attitude toward himself. If he is sometimes self-deprecating, does he reveal it through some physical tic, or in things he says when he first meets people? If he is arrogant, what does he do that will make the reader feel he is arrogant without his saying a word? An arrogant action, I find, works better than arrogant speech. I have seen talented writers hurt their chances of publication because they persist in writing about perfectly ordinary people. Of course, there have been numerous successful novels in which the main characters were not extraordinary. What the writers mean by perfectly ordinary people are characters who are seemingly no different from the run of people we meet who do not seem in any way distinctive. People who are exactly like other people probably don't exist. But people who seem like most other people litter our lives, and we don't usually seek their company because they are boring. Readers don't read novels in order to experience the boredom they often experience in life. They want to meet interesting people, extraordinary people, preferably people different from anyone they've met before in or out of fiction. The experienced writer will give us characters, even in common walks of life, who seem extraordinary on first acquaintance. Are there exceptions? Of course. In my novel, The Resort, the leading characters are an ordinary, middle-aged couple, Henry and Margaret Brown, who find themselves in horrific circumstances at the end of Chapter 1. If Henry and Margaret Brown were truly ordinary, they wouldn't have interested the reader. And so I had Margaret Brown become a physician at a time when few women were in medical school. I also made her outspoken, extraordinarily curious, and smart as hell. And I had Henry, a businessman, spend his off hours in ways few businessmen do. I made the Browns just different enough to interest the reader, but it was important that they not seem special. Therefore, when calamity hits the Browns, readers from any walk of life can identify with their plight, which is critical for the story. Stephen King usually has quite ordinary-seeming characters get involved in extraordinary circumstances. In most instances, however, you'll want to make your characters as distinctive as possible rather than ordinary. The extraordinary quality of a character should usually be made evident almost immediately after he or she appears in the story, unless the thrust of the story is to have the gradual unveiling of a character's unusual habits or ambition. Beware of characters who are so extreme as to seem like cartoon characters. Some characters in Charles Dickens' novels seem wildly exaggerated. Such characters are difficult to make credible to readers of mainstream fiction today. Most authors seek high ground between the character who seems perfectly ordinary, and therefore uninteresting, and the wildly exaggerated cartoon-like character. Let's get a fix on the most fertile areas of characterization. What makes a character extraordinary? Personality, disposition, temperament, individuality, eccentricity? How much overlap is there? Let's explore each of those terms in as much depth as we can. My students find that their work in characterization improves markedly after they've considered the full span of meaning of those terms. First, personality. We know that people at a party will cluster around people with personality. Personality refers to the distinctive traits of an individual, a set of behaviors, attitudes, manners, and mannerisms that identify a person. Personality speaks of an individual's makeup, nature, and combined traits, his essence. It means the specialness of a person, which in some may involve likability, power, charm, magnetism, and charisma. The constituent parts of a personality are disposition, temperament, individuality, and eccentricity. I'm not pushing these definitions as definitive. I'm trying to suggest that exploring an important term in depth can produce a stimulating variety of definitions that are valuable tools for thinking about a character. The disposition of a person is her attitude toward the people and places of the world, her customary response, particularly her emotional response. Disposition can involve a person's qualities, outlook, mood, frame of mind, inclination, bent, bias, tendency and direction, her proclivity, predilection, penchant, and propensity. Today, disposition is sometimes thought of as a predisposition, a mindset. As you can now see, there are inspiring convolutions of meaning for these words that together define what a writer is trying to achieve in characterization. Temperament is a person's manner of behaving, thinking, and particularly reacting to people and circumstances, his characteristic way of confronting a new day or a new development. Temperament can also be seen as a person's mettle, spirit, leaning, or inclination. Temperament often connotes a negative tendency toward anger or irritability, though the term even temperament, of course, means the opposite. Individuality is the aggregate of qualities that distinguishes one individual from others. It connotes that person's distinctiveness, difference, and most important, her originality and uniqueness. A writer describes a character's singularity with the particulars of concrete detail. These are the characteristics by which an individual is recognized by others. Her differentness is her identity. It can be said that the individuality of a person marks her off, singles her out, sets her apart, and ultimately defines her. I've left for last a definition that speaks most to the point of giving your characters special and unusual characteristics. Eccentricity is an offbeat manner of behavior, dress, or speech that is particular to a person and greatly dissimilar to the same characteristics of most other people. We think of the eccentric person as odd, a card, perhaps somewhat kinky, a queer fish, a quirky individual different from the other people we know. When we speak of an eccentric person, don't we refer to him or her as a character? The idiosyncrasies of a person are, of course, as seen by others rather than that person, who often believes his or her idiosyncrasies to be perfectly normal. Eccentricity is at the heart of strong characterization. The most effective characters have profound roots in human behavior. Their richest feelings may be similar to those held by many others. However, as characters, their eccentricities dominate the reader's first vision of them. If you were to examine the surviving novels of this century, you would find that a majority of the most memorable characters in fiction are to some degree eccentric. Eccentricity has frequently been at the heart of strong characterization for good reason. Ordinariness, as I've said, is what readers have enough of in life. When a great number of young men take to wearing an earring, that is not an eccentricity. When young women iron their hair, as many did in the 60s, that is not an eccentricity. They are conforming to a widespread group mode. Eccentric behavior is sometimes said to be nutty behavior, implying strange behavior, which is perfectly suitable for fiction. But nutty can also mean crazy, which is not intended here for an important reason. There are two types seldom seen in fiction: people who are psychotic and habitual drunks. Readers find it difficult to identify with their behavior. There are exceptions, of course, as in horror stories. In Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, the leading character is crazy, though we don't know it for certain until quite near the end. Alcoholics sometimes play secondary roles in novels, and there have been several novels featuring alcoholic individuals or couples. But the most memorable alcoholic, who saw a giant rabbit called Harvey, involved a playful use of alcoholism that would probably not be attempted today with the recognition of the severity of the illness. Dostoevsky's opening of Notes from Underground has a character explaining himself. He is so self-contradictory that when I read this opening aloud to students, they invariably laugh. "I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. An unattractive man. I think that my liver hurts. But actually, I don't know a damn thing about my illness. I am not even sure what it is that hurts. I am not in treatment and never have been, although I respect both medicine and doctors. Besides, I am superstitious in the extreme. Well, at least to the extent of respecting medicine. I am sufficiently educated not to be superstitious, but I am. No, sir, I refuse to see a doctor simply out of spite. Now that is something that you probably will fail to understand." Consider also Captain Ahab in Melville's Moby Dick, certainly an eccentric. In Mark Twain's celebrated novels, what captures our attention is not the ordinariness of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, but their eccentricity. Think of the 20th-century novels of Hemingway, Faulkner, Graham Greene, Kafka, Garcia Marquez, Fitzgerald, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, J.D. Salinger, or the short stories of John Cheever. Their most memorable work springs from eccentric characters. Think of the most eccentric person you know. What makes him or her eccentric? What is the most eccentric thing they have ever done? What might they do that would seem even more eccentric? Then think of your character doing that very thing. Unlikely? Unreasonable? Surprising? All of the above? If such behavior would be out of character for your protagonist, then what variation of it would be in character? If your character isn't capable of any important eccentricity, you may have picked a character who will not be greatly interesting to readers. People notice the eccentricity of others. They talk about it with their friends. It becomes the subject of gossip and rumination. When people do only what they are expected to do, they don't make us eager to spend a dozen hours in their company. You may be wondering if I am suggesting too much complexity in characterization. I don't expect you to use it all, but your explorations will stimulate thoughts that add to the potential richness of the characterization. To the extent that the complexity reflects the intricacy of human nature, the characters will come alive to the reader and remain alive in the reader's memory. One reason characters in transient fiction don't linger in the reader's memory is the shallowness of the characterization. If Ian Fleming's James Bond is remembered, it is as a kind of cartoon character. The reader doesn't concern himself whether James Bond lives or dies, except when he is in the middle of reading a James Bond story, and even then he doesn't worry much because the cartoon character has to live another day for another book. Sherlock Holmes is a wonderful character, but we don't think about him as we would about a member of our family or a close friend, living or dead. We think of him as a character in a book or film. In the best of mainstream fiction and in literary fiction, the most complex characters seem to graduate to a permanent place in our memory, as good friends do. The same is true of villains. Professor Moriarty doesn't occupy our lives except when we are reading about him. But the reader carries the memory of Iago and Lady Macbeth for a lifetime. Contrast is a useful technique for characterization. It sometimes has the extra virtue of surprise. I recall attending a convention once where I sat in back of a large room. Several rows ahead of me sat a woman dressed in an immaculately tailored gray suit, her hair kempt, her posture markedly straight, and she was picking her nose. What helped characterize her for me was the contrast between her appearance and her nose-picking. Characterizing through unusual clothing or the manner of wearing clothing is another often neglected possibility. What it requires is to avoid the easy description that first comes to mind. Jerry always wore his cap backwards isn't writerly. It can be improved. His cap worn backwards was a message to the world. Jerry did things differently. A layman might say, "Ellen looked terrific in her gown." That's top-of-the-head writing, which can be improved. In her gown, Ellen looked like the stamen of a flower made of silk. The first description doesn't say anything particular about either Ellen or the gown. The second is visual and tells us how Ellen and the gown came across in a way that made them both look good. One of my students took the easy way out in describing his character Martin. Martin was an informal dresser who didn't like other men getting all dressed up. I persuaded him to rethink the sentence. Martin referred to men who wore shirts and ties all day, not as people, but as suits. An important technique that is used too seldom by novelists is to give a character life by introducing attributes that go against the character's dominant behavior in the scene to come. Early in The Best Revenge, there is a scene in which the hero, the Broadway producer Ben Riller, whose current play is in severe financial difficulty, goes to see Aldo Manucci, the moneylender Ben's father used to go to many years earlier. In the scene, done from Ben's point of view, Ben is in the position of pleading for money, and Aldo, presumably, has the power to save him. Therefore, in characterizing Aldo on his first appearance, I gave him a variety of weaknesses. At last she wheeled him in, a shrunken human stuffed by a careless taxidermist. He was trying to hold his head up to see me, an eye clouded by cataract. He took an unblinking look, then let a rich smile lift the ends of his mouth as his voice, still bass though tremulous, said, "Ben," which made my name sound like the word good in Italian. A common fault in fiction is the portrayal of characters as all good or all bad. Therefore, when introducing a character who will be in a position of power in a scene, suggest that character's vulnerability before the character exercises power. Conversely, when introducing a character who will be hurt emotionally or physically in the scene to come, show the character's strength at the outset. In a short story, there is usually time for only one event or episode. A character comes to life, the event takes place, the story's over. There is room for a change of attitude toward something specific. Most often, there isn't room in a short story for a character to experience enough to cause a profound change. In a novel, it is common and desirable for the principal character to change by the end of the book. If the protagonist is a risk-taker, he may step into adulthood by learning that some kinds of risks are foolhardy. If the protagonist accepts certain conditions as a part of life, he may have learned that some of those conditions can change. And the protagonist, who at the start is a pessimist about human nature, may discover that a single human being can make a difference for a large number of fellow humans. These are just a few examples of how a character might change in the course of a novel. The writer has to ask, is the change consistent with the character as portrayed? A change can be surprising, but it should not seem out of sync with what we know about the character. Somerset Maugham said, "You can never know enough about your characters." When you have trouble improving a particular characterization, you need to know more. The remedy may lie in viewing your character from a different perspective. Another way is to have your character complain bitterly about something. In life, complaining is more effective when it is done in a normal voice, the words speaking for themselves. However, bitter complaining connotes an emotional overload. At such times, your character is speaking, as it were, from the gut or the heart rather than the head. Listen to the character in that state. It will help you with the part of characterization that is normally hidden from public view. Imagine your adult character secretly dressed in children's clothes. Why is he doing that? What you want is not your answer, but the character's answer to that question. The child in an adult character may have a poignant memory of a lasting hurt, or a marvelous secret to reveal. Yet another way is to visualize your character as suddenly rather old. How would that change her appearance, dress, walk? Is there anything that you can incorporate in your characterization at your character's present age? Some people preserve characteristics of their childhood. Others seem prematurely old in some way. So do some characters. Imagine your character in an armchair talking to you. Ask your character questions that are provocative. Let your character challenge you. Disagree with your character. Let him win the argument. Unfetter your imagination. Can you see your character flapping arms, trying to fly, or trying to kiss everyone at a party, or walking in the snow without shoes? Readers are interested in the out of the ordinary. All these questions involve the character in action, the ideal way to characterize. Last, imagine your character in the nude. This one almost always works if you portray your character in the nude honestly and in detail. People in the nude become especially vulnerable. This doesn't mean you should necessarily portray your character actually in the nude. Your character may not want to get undressed, or may want to dress quickly to cover up, or your character can just be thinking in the bath or shower. An author of mine, Edwin Corley, had a remarkable success with a first novel called Siege, which started with a scene of a black general in his bathtub. Everything the general did later was more believable because a person seen realistically in the nude is immediately credible. Characterizing villains. Once upon a time, readers tolerated mustache-twirling villains with no countervailing virtues in their makeup. Today's readers can be roughly divided into two groups: those who accept the fantasy villains of childhood, as in the James Bond stories and Arnold Schwarzenegger films, and those who insist on credibility. In life, villains do not uncurl whips and snarl. They seem like normal human beings. But normal human beings are not villains. What distinguishes the true villain is not just the degree to which he hides his villainy under an attractive patina to snare his victims, but his contact with evil. There is no social solution to the true villain's villainy. He cannot be re-educated and become a nice guy. His villainy is an ineradicable part of his nature. In the successful TV series NYPD Blue, a senior police official from outside the precinct makes the precinct's captain's life miserable at every opportunity. The official is not a nice guy. He is a bad guy. The audience dislikes him more than it dislikes the criminals who are brought in. Every time the official hurts one of the good cops, we wish something bad would happen to him. Then, when the official overreaches and blunders, we are exhilarated. The official has boxed himself into a corner. We like that. Finally, when the official has to choose between defending a civil lawsuit he can't win and resigning from the force, we are joyful. The villain is getting his due. What the writers have been doing with this character all along, of course, is manipulating our emotions, which is exactly what your role is when you are pitting characters against each other to create a story. Some suggestions to consider in characterizing an antagonist. Can he have a physical mannerism that would be at least slightly disturbing to most people? For instance, an involuntary blinking of one eye, or sniffing, frequent nose wrinkling, earlobe pulling, elbow scratching. It is the repetitive nature of such mannerisms that grates on readers. How does your antagonist behave toward people he's never met before? Does he effuse charm? Is he overly deferential? Or is he discourteous, uninterested, openly bored, arrogant? All of these are characteristics that would help form the reader's attitude toward your villain. Another possibility is to have your antagonist do something frequently that most people do only occasionally. For instance, does he blow his nose every few minutes, though he is not sick? Does his forehead sweat a lot, though it is not especially hot? Does he scratch himself, cough unnecessarily, wink at others as if there were some implied meaning in what they or he were saying? To weave individual characteristics into a story, as much as possible, let them come out during or as part of an action. The object is to avoid holding up the story and to keep the writer's explanations out of it. To see how it's done, let's examine a work in progress in which a successful young businessman, driving to work in what becomes a severe rainstorm, passes a hitchhiker, then, out of compassion and guilt, turns his car around to pick the man up. As the man clambered in, I could see he was one of those assless thin fellows who hikes his pants up higher than most men do. The hitchhiker had his hand stretched out to shake. I was of the belief that hitchhikers, like waiters and mailmen, don't offer their hand, but this man's was stuck out there like an embarrassment, so I held onto the wheel hard with my left hand and put my right hand out to shake the man's rain-wet palm. I could tell the man's breath was the kind that toothpaste didn't cure. The hitchhiker introduces himself. Even his name has an evil sound. He is characterized by clothing, sight, smell, and now touch. The skin of Uck's hand seemed flaked, reptilian. Even when the man tried to smile, his face didn't cooperate. Like Peter Lorre's, his lips thinned, but that was all. I thought if this man's mother had pressed a pillow on his nose and mouth when he was a baby, would anyone have convicted her? The protagonist is so repulsed by what he sees, smells, and touches of the hitchhiker that his mind jumps to wishing the man dead. That puts the reader's emotion on the defensive. The reader, whatever his conduct in private life, doesn't believe or wish to believe that he would hope a man would drop dead just because he was repulsive. Hey, the reader thinks, this guy's human. That's the key, of course. Uck is human. We meet his wife and child. He can be charming if he wants to. Nevertheless, he is fundamentally evil in the way he attaches himself to the life of the protagonist and won't let go. He is not just getting a lift in the rain. He is the leech that cannot be pulled off the skin. Uck has taken the first step in pushing himself into the protagonist's life and has begun the process of forcing the protagonist out of his job and home, a true villain. You need to ask yourself about your antagonist. Is he curable? Is he bad but can be straightened out? Bad will work, but evil will provide a more profound experience for the reader. We have seen that wimpishness is off-putting in a protagonist. We have a sense that will, desire reinforced by ambition, is what makes protagonists drive us through their stories. In the example just given, the protagonist is intensely interested in his work that has brought him a comfortable life, his wife, his house. The hitchhiker who appears in the rainstorm is set to take that from him and cannot be bought off by ransom of any kind. From that clash of these two characters, we get the kind of conflict that attracts readers. Characterizing minor players. Major characters deserve and get our primary attention. That doesn't mean we should settle for stereotypes for minor characters. Sometimes they are given a name, a sex, an age, and no characterization. I've seen minor characters given too much characterization, fooling the reader into thinking that they had some larger role to play. Sometimes all you want is for the reader to be able to see the minor character. Here's how Nancy Kincaid does it. You think you never saw White completely until you see Roy's butt. The most efficient technique for making minor characters come alive is to select one memorable characteristic that singles them out from the rest of humanity. This is particularly true for fleeting characters, those that appear and vanish, not to return. Early in Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, the reader comes upon, "The priest was young and blushed easily." In just 7 words, the priest is visible even before his special uniform is described. Note that blushing is an action that characterizes, important here because the priest, in military service, is about to be picked on by a senior officer. Irwin Shaw, in a story called No Jury Would Convict, shows us this. The man in the green sweater took off his yellow straw hat and carefully wiped the sweatband with his handkerchief. Simple enough, but what makes us see that man is not a description of what he is wearing, but an action, wiping the sweatband. When a writer characterizes beautifully, we indulge him. Every page of Dennis MacFarlane's first novel, The Music Room, is a delight because it is so well written. MacFarlane doesn't pass up any opportunity to characterize. Here's how he deals with the most minor of characters, a hotel desk clerk, seen from the point of view of the protagonist whose brother has just died. The man behind the hotel desk, whom I had never seen before, dark and sporting the handlebar mustache of a lion tamer in a circus, seemed to know me and to know my trouble. I watched him cheerfully help a man just ahead of me, then turned decidedly sorrowful as he shifted his gaze in my direction. It was with great sympathy that he handed me the pink slips of paper on which my telephone messages were written, and I couldn't help noticing that the skin on his hand appeared a bit too moist and white, and the several hairs on the back of it were a bit too coarse and black, individual and rooted, as if magnified. Characterizing a minor character through the eyes of an important character is a valuable technique. Note how Anne Richardson-Roifa does it in Up the Sandbox. The dwarf lady who lives in our building is hurrying across the street, her shopping bag filled, her fat legs bare, and her feet encased in their usual heavy orthopedic shoes. Her face is round and her features are broad, distorted by thick glasses. I had never seen a dwarf till we moved to this building. It's been 4 years now, and each time we pass, my skin crawls. Despite all the humane teachings I have, of course, heard, I still feel not considerate, compassionate, or easy in the company of cripples. I hold to the medieval conviction that someone has been criminal, perhaps in bed, or maybe only in imagination, but someone has committed a crime, perhaps the victim herself. Minor characters can not only help characterize the major players in a story, but can also advance the plot. In the first 3 pages of The Best Revenge, I introduce five characters in addition to the protagonist in order to characterize the protagonist, Ben Riller, and to get the main plot line going. Ben is in trouble. A theatrical producer, Ben is just entering the reception room of his office. An elderly messenger is at the desk of Ben's assistant, Charlotte. She is trying to signal to him, but Ben's attention is on the waiting actors. Let's see how the messenger is used. The geriatric who'd been wrangling with Charlotte spots me at last. Some of the best actors in the world are close to 80. Their age-lined faces exude character. In the movies, you can do repeated takes, but in the theater, the scourges of the body haunt 8 performances a week. Old people chip at my heart. I see my father, Louis, in every one of their faces. It aches to turn an old man down. I smile as he approaches me. I think he wants to shake my hand. What he wants to do, it turns out, is to provide me with personal service of a subpoena. I try to hand it back to him, but he's out the door with a gait a younger man would envy. I used the messenger to help fill out the characterization of the protagonist, Ben. Characterizing a minor player gives us a chance to characterize a major player. In that same paragraph, several other things come across. The reader learns the producer's feelings about the theater, age, the differences for actors in film and on the stage. It also introduces the producer's father, Louis, a major character. The point to note is that when depicting a minor character, you can seize the opportunity to convey much else. The most important thing in that brief bit with the messenger is that it takes us, through an action, into the heart of the plot. The hero, Ben Riller, the successful producer, is in trouble. The point I want to leave you with is that the permutations of character are endless, and the techniques for achieving them are many. When you are engaged in the complex task of characterization, consider the techniques in this chapter the equivalent of calling 911. I have tried in this chapter to convey a variety of ways to characterize both minor and major characters. I have an additional suggestion. Spend some time reading or rereading 2 or 3 of the classics in which characterization is both profound and memorable, the novels of Dostoevsky and Flaubert from other cultures, Shakespeare's great plays, particularly the tragedies, such 20th century writers as Joseph Conrad, Graham Greene, Henry James, to pluck a few from among the many. You'll find that one of the characters resonates in your memory or speaks to your view of life more than most. As you are readying yourself for sleep, imagine a scene in which that character and the character you are working on have a conversation about the story of your book. Imagine what one says and how the other answers. In due course, let yourself sleep. You might find that in the first moments of wakefulness the next morning, you'll want to reach for a pad and paper at your bedside to record some thoughts about your character, enriched by his or her conversation with a character you loved. Ultimately, the job of characterization among the best of writers is governed by that writer's understanding of human nature. In the early 20th century, a novel called Pollyanna by Eleanor Porter put a new word into our language. Pollyanna has come to stand for a blindly optimistic person. We speak of an ostrich attitude, putting one's head into the sand, pretending what is out there and real does not exist. A writer cannot be a Pollyanna. He is in the business of writing what other people think but don't say, which leads us to markers, the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 5. Markers, the Key to Swift Characterization. Lionel Trilling, one of the influential critics of the mid-20th century, who was also an infrequent but interesting writer of fiction, declared that fiction at its heart involved the differences between classes. While this observation is invaluable to writers of fiction, it is also a match tossed into flammable material. The fact that acute differences exist between social and cultural classes seems to be acknowledged in most of the world, but in the United States, where democracy is often confounded with egalitarianism, even the idea that social classes exist has long been taboo. It is, however, a writer's specialty to deal with taboos, to speak the unspoken, to reveal, to uncover, to show in the interaction of people the difference between what we profess and how we act. Moreover, because touchy subjects arouse emotion, they are especially useful for the writer who knows that arousing the emotions of his audience is the test of his skill. When we discuss cultural differences, we are not talking about economic differences or equal opportunity. Cultural differences arise from inherited characteristics, upbringing, and individual temperament. The best literary fiction often confronts these differences. Even transient or popular fiction can benefit from an awareness by the writer of this rich load. Wonderful stories can be crafted about people's inherited characteristics, upbringing, and individual temperament. Characters, just like people, can strive to overcome this baggage and training. Some people succeed in doing so, some can't, and the same is true of the characters available to our imaginations. Many dramatic moments in theater and film come from clashes between characters based on differences in background. How can we overlook the source of audience interest in Shaw's Pygmalion or its rendering as a musical in My Fair Lady? Put the garish and tacky Eliza Doolittle in touch with Henry Higgins, and you have a clash of social and cultural differences instantly recognized by millions. These differences are at the heart of what is, in my judgment, the best play by the best American playwright of the 20th century, Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire. The play and film derive their power from the cultural conflict between Blanche DuBois, the fallen lady, and Stanley Kowalski, the blue-collar brute, who strip each other's pretenses, witnessed by Stella, who married beneath her, and found herself in the world of card-playing, beer-swilling male animals. Characters of different cultural classes caught in a crucible are, of course, ideal for fiction. The dramatic heat generated by cultural differences, inherited or nurtured, added to the differences of individual temperaments, can help writers create wonderful stories. These differences are a valuable resource for scenes as well as entire plots. It is the underlying basis of conflict in fiction. Most people, regardless of their background, prefer others whom they think of as their own kind, which means that there is a widespread prejudice against the other kinds. While this prejudice can be controlled and even overcome to some degree in life, a vestige of feeling about otherness remains even in most people who deny it. That feeling of otherness is useful to the writer in plotting, because readers' emotions can be quickly committed when they observe two characters of differing backgrounds in the same story. It is useful for writers to step onto the thin ice of this subject matter with a clear understanding of terms and meanings. A culture consists of the behavior patterns, beliefs, traditions, institutions, taste, and other characteristics of a community passed from one generation to another. The adjective cultured is usually used to connote a superior level of aesthetic and intellectual development that results from education and training. A class is a stratum of society whose members share cultural and social characteristics. Class, used by itself, as in she had class, connotes superior style or quality. Good writers have come from every imaginable social class, and some stand ready to defend their turf. A writer has to squelch his emotional reactions consciously in order to get enough distance to use them in his work as a writer. People in civil society usually try to overlook the kind of differences we have been talking about, but they don't succeed. Their attempts to cover up noticed differences sometimes fail, hurting others. In general, cultural differences are noticed by almost everybody. When people learn to set aside cultural differences, we speak of them as open-minded. Yet, open-minded people sometimes say inappropriate things to make people of other social classes feel more at home. This makes the others feel less comfortable, not more comfortable. Therefore, despite noble intentions, social and cultural differences can be a source of high feeling and high drama. As we shall see, for plotting purposes, differences are more important than similarities. Action movies categorize people into good guys and bad guys. In many of the films that are nominated for Academy Awards, the discernment of differences becomes more subtle. That discernment becomes a necessity in the best literary and mainstream fiction. The butting together of characters of different backgrounds can be extreme, as in D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. It can produce comedy if a good old boy joins the ladies and gentlemen of Virginia on a fox hunt. What we expect of a good old boy is that, while he too hunts for pleasure, it is in the company of men who hunt in packs, dressed in rough clothes, who would laugh at the gaudy dress of traditional fox hunters. Social and cultural differences strike sparks both for the writer and the reader. In literary fiction, the clash of differences is often more subtle than in My Fair Lady or A Streetcar Named Desire. One of my favorite stories, which won a place in the Best Short Stories of 1991, was Kate Braverman's Tall Tales from the Mekong Delta. Let's look at the beginning of that remarkable story and observe the clash of background and values. It was in the fifth month of her sobriety. It was after the hospital. It was after her divorce. It was autumn. She had even stopped smoking. She was wearing pink aerobic pants, a pink T-shirt with kawaii written in lilac across the chest, and tennis shoes. She had just come from the gym. Her black hair was damp. She was wearing a pink sweatband around her forehead. She was walking across a parking lot bordering a city park in West Hollywood. She was carrying cookies for the AA meeting. She was in charge of bringing the food for the meeting. He fell into step with her. He was short, fat, pale. He had bad teeth. His hair was dirty. Later, she would freeze this frame in her mind and study it. She would say he seemed frightened and defeated and trapped. Cagey was the word she used to describe his eyes, how he measured and evaluated something in the air between them. The way he squinted through hazel eyes, it had nothing to do with the sunlight. "I'm Lenny," he said, extending his hand. "What's your name?" She told him. She was holding a bag with packages of cookies in it. After the meeting, she had an appointment with her psychiatrist, then a manicure. She kept walking. "You a teacher? You look like a teacher," he said. "I'm a writer," she told him. "I teach creative writing." "You look like a teacher," Lenny said. "I'm not just a teacher," she told him. She was annoyed. "Okay, you're a writer, and you're bad. You're one of those bad girls from Beverly Hills. I've had my eye on you," Lenny said. She didn't say anything. He was wearing blue jeans, a black leather jacket zipped to his throat, a long red wool scarf around his neck, and a Dodgers baseball cap. It was too hot a day for the leather jacket and scarf. She didn't find that detail significant. It caught her attention. She touched it briefly and then let it go. She looked, but did not see. They were standing on a curb. The meeting was in a community room across the boulevard. She wasn't afraid yet. "You do drugs? What do? Drink too much?" he asked. The narrator and Lenny come from different worlds. We find out how different as the story goes on. Lenny is invading her world just as Henry Higgins invaded Eliza's, and Blanche DuBois invaded Stanley's, with different intent, of course. The reader senses the difference early from the clothes they are wearing, from the woman's fear and need to be polite, and Lenny's impolite, aggressive questioning and assumptions. The process of identifying different worlds for the reader can be accomplished quickly through markers, easily identified signals that, to a majority of readers, will reveal a character's cultural and social background. Clothing, as we've seen, is a useful marker. A woman in a tailored suit suggests formality. Would we expect to see that woman walking in the street with a man wearing a totally sleeveless muscle shirt or a cap with a slogan on it? The reader assumes they are not together because they have the appurtenances of widely different backgrounds. But if they are walking arm in arm, what is the reader to think or feel? Today, people of every background seem to wear jeans, but if a man wears designer jeans with a pressed crease, do we assume he's just come off his job at a construction site? Suppose the reader sees someone on a construction site who is wearing designer jeans with a pressed crease. What does the reader think? He thinks phony. Phoniness can be useful to a writer. While no marker is an absolute designation of background or class, there are exceptions to almost all of them, the reader will feel a reaction to the markers. For instance, if we are in a courtroom where a young man is being charged with a criminal offense, what do we expect to see? We expect that his lawyer will have made him get dressed up, often with a suit and tie. If in that courtroom the same young man is dressed in his usual cut-off blue jeans, dirty sneakers, and a T-shirt with an obscene slogan, what would we think? That his lawyer had neglected to do his job? What would the judge think? Surely the judge knows that lawyers dress up their clients. Will the judge think that the lawyer or client is showing contempt for the dignity of the court? The reaction to clothing is often a reaction to the surroundings in which the clothing is worn. Keep that in mind when you're describing a character in a specific scene. When in fiction, theater, and film, the writer brings together people of differing social and cultural backgrounds, he needs to step back to watch the inherent drama of differences explode. Differences assume opposition. That's what makes writing dramatic. If dealing with social and cultural differences makes the writer uneasy, that's good. Emotion-inciting material is the most desirable kind. If social and cultural differences between characters excite emotion, the tension of any story will surely increase. Many aspects of cultural class distinction have been used in fiction. Some characteristics that once denoted upper and lower classes have diffused in time. In countries with diverse cultures like the United States, regional differences sometimes become more apparent than class distinctions. Generational differences also produce changes. For instance, while a conspicuous tattoo still suggests lower class to the reader, and the larger the tattoo, the lower the class, in recent years, some young people of all classes have had themselves tattooed with small objects such as a heart, a rose, or a butterfly. Though the characteristics that once connoted lower class and upper class to readers are no longer absolutes, they still work as markers in which readers find connotations and associations. Those markers continue to be invaluable to the writer. Let's look at some common markers, some of which have been overused. Hair worn in curlers under a headscarf in public usually connotes lower class to readers. For a woman, fingernails the size of animal claws and garish nail polish used to make a statement about class. Claw-like fingernails and excessive rouge continue to suggest unsophisticated artifice, which can be useful to a writer. Black under the fingernails of a man dressed up to go out might be a marker of a person who does dirty work with his hands and never quite gets them clean. The writer doesn't have to say what I've just said. All he has to show the reader are the fingernails. They are effective markers. Public conduct with children is an immediate marker. A woman walking with a dressed-up child connotes one thing. A woman screaming at her children in the supermarket suggests another. What does the incessant chewing of gum suggest about a character? What would an ankle bracelet convey to a reader about a character? What about a man wearing multiple large rings or a diamond ring? Mannerisms can be important markers. How does the reader react to a male character who publicly picks his nose, scratches under his arms, and in his crotch? Would the reader instantly assume that the character is couth or uncouth? Even the transportation used by a character can be a marker. If a reader knew nothing about a character except that he owned a pickup truck, a motorcycle, and a souped-up car with oversized tires and a noisy muffler, what would the reader think about that character's background? Food, drink, and the places they are consumed are markers. If the reader knows a character drinks popular brands of American beer, rye whiskey, and chilled red wine, what does the reader guess about the character's background? If the character drinks scotch, Perrier, and martinis straight up, does the reader have a different view? Of course. These markers are useful. Fizzy wine or coolers would not be the choice of people with educated palates. Nor would you be likely to find people with educated palates online in a fast food takeout joint. Conversely, a construction worker, even if dressed in his Sunday best, is likely to feel mighty uncomfortable in one of Manhattan's posh East Side restaurants, where all the waiters are dressed in black tie and the menu is in French. If your character brought his mouth down to his food rather than his food up to his mouth, the reader would likely draw an instant assumption about his upbringing. However, some distinctions in eating habits are poor markers because they are too complex to describe succinctly. For instance, the British use a fork in the left hand and a knife in the right. The left hand brings the cut food to the mouth. Americans keep switching hands and bring food to the mouth with the right hand. Distinctions of that sort are not good markers for the writer because they require too much description, and readers might still not get the point without the author telling them explicitly. A marker should convey its point instantly. Perhaps the most frequently used marker is found in the vocabulary and expressions of a character's dialogue. If a character uses words like ostensibly, exacerbate, primordial, correctly, and with ease, what would you, as a reader, think about them? That vocabulary is indicative of someone who is well-educated, but it could also reflect a pompous person. One of the most common vocabulary markers is heard on television when a police officer talks about a perpetrator. In most of my novels, I have at least one character with an accent, a distinguishing marker. In The Best Revenge, at least three characters have accent markers that differ noticeably from each other. Many politicians speak in incomplete sentences peppered with clichés. Street people use four-letter words and vulgar expressions. All of these markers characterize quickly. The content of a character's speech can also generate markers. If a character displays knowledge of what went on in previous centuries, is interested in international issues, reads books and appreciates them as physical objects, and votes regularly as a matter of principle, what will the reader think about his or her background? Markers provide the writer with an opportunity to show the character's background instead of telling the reader about it. Attitudes can also be used as markers. Arthur came to New York expecting to be insulted or mugged by every passerby. An inexperienced attitude toward travel can be an important marker, for instance, a preference for group tours, being intimidated by foreign languages and customs, or buying up mass-produced souvenirs. However, be wary of cliché markers, such as an American tourist abroad in search of a restaurant that serves hamburgers. I have a strong preference for action markers, that is, sentences that describe what a character does and at the same time reveal something about the character's upbringing or background. Every time Zelda ate in a restaurant, she found some reason to send food back to the kitchen. Louis always played it safe by overtipping the waiter. As usual, Angelica let her food get cold because she was busy watching everyone else in the restaurant. We have just seen three quite different instant characterizations in the same location, a restaurant. I have sometimes found that even accomplished writers neglect to ask themselves some fundamental questions about their important characters that could provide useful markers. For instance, what trait inherited by the protagonist has most influenced his adult life? What custom of the protagonist's family still haunts his life? Which personal habit has he tried to break unsuccessfully for years? What family tradition has had the most positive influence on the protagonist? What is the single most important factor in the villain's upbringing that contributed to his reprehensible conduct? If you are presently writing a novel, have you examined it to see if there are some social or class differences between your two most important characters? How do those differences influence your story? If you have neglected such differences, how might you bolster your story by adding some social and cultural differences that arouse emotion? And now that you're mastering the creation of characters, it's time to ask, how do you plot that story? Chapter 6. Thwarting Desire, the Basis of Plotting. We are driven through life by our needs and wants. So must the characters we create be motivated by what they want. The driving force of characters is their desire. Inexperienced writers, sometimes ill-read in the great works of their own and previous times, often try to write novels with a relatively passive protagonist who wants little or has largely given up wanting. I have met more than one writer who says that his character doesn't want anything, he just wants to live his life. That always brings to mind something Kurt Vonnegut said. When I used to teach creative writing, I would tell the students to make their characters want something right away, even if it's only a glass of water. Characters paralyzed by the meaninglessness of modern life still have to drink water from time to time. The most interesting stories involve characters who want something badly. In Kafka's The Trial, Joseph K. wants to know why he is being arrested, why he is being tried, what he is guilty of. In Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, the central character constructs his life with the sole object of reuniting with Daisy, the woman he loves. In Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Emma Bovary, her head full of romantic notions, wants to escape the dreariness of her husband and her life. If your character doesn't want anything badly enough, readers will have a hard time rooting for him to attain his goal, which is what compels readers to continue reading. The more urgent the want, the greater the reader's interest. A far future want does not set the reader's pulse going the way an immediate want does. The want can be negative, wanting something not to happen, as in Frederick Forsyth's The Day of the Jackal, in which the reader hopes that de Gaulle will escape the assassin's bullet. In the chapter on characterization, I suggested that some of the most memorable characters in fiction were eccentric. To carry the point a step further, I suggest relating the character's deepest desire to the character's fundamental difference from other characters, especially the character of the antagonist. Which brings us to the essence of plotting. Putting the protagonist's desire and the antagonist's desire into sharp conflict. If the conflict isn't sharp, the tension will be lax. One way to plan is to think of what would most thwart your protagonist's want, then give the power to thwart that want to the antagonist. And be certain there is a two-way urgency. Your protagonist wants a particular, important desire fulfilled as soon as possible, and the antagonist wants to wreck the chance of that happening also as soon as possible. Those are the three keys. The want and the opposition to the want need to be important, necessary, and urgent. The result should be the kind of conflict that interests readers. A word of caution. These plotting guidelines are basic and to some degree simplistic. They are intended to provide the writer with the easiest route to publication. The well-read writer will be familiar with complex plots that deviate from the norm. What they do not deviate from is the fierce desire of the protagonist and the conflict engendered by obstacles. The essence of dramatic conflict lies in the clash of wants. You need to be certain that the conflicting wants are connected significantly and are over something that the reader will view as important. For instance, if the hero wants to preserve his valuable stamp collection, and the villain has stolen it and intends to sell the items in it piecemeal to conceal his theft, their wants are clearly on a collision course. However, ask yourself, does the reader care enough about the stamp collection? If the stamp collection belonged to President Franklin Roosevelt, an avid stamp collector, the theft of that collection could have interfered with matters of state until it was resolved. The reader will care about the stamp collection to the degree that he cares about the protagonist and what the protagonist loves. That's one of the reasons why the best plots develop out of character. It is easier for the reader to identify with a want that is close to universal and not too specialized. A stamp collection is relatively specialized. The wants that interest a majority of readers include gaining or losing a love, achieving a lifetime ambition, seeing that justice is done, saving a life, seeking revenge, and accomplishing a task that at first seemed impossible. In transient fiction, sometimes called commercial or popular fiction, the wants are less personal and often more melodramatic. Events happen rather than grow out of character. Though my personal preference is for literary fiction, I have worked with a number of highly successful professional best-selling novelists who didn't seem to care whether their characters were remembered years later. They mastered craft. Their storytelling was suspenseful and compelling for large numbers of readers. The wants of their characters tended to be different from those in literary fiction. For them and other writers of popular fiction, the following wants were paramount: defeating the plans of a national enemy, blocking an assassin out to kill an important person, rescuing someone close to the hero, solving an important crime. The clash between your characters can be based on almost anything, as long as it is involved with their desires. The most common causes of clash are money, love, and power. Power connotes control, usually over other human beings. Therefore, in a community of two people, if one has power, the other doesn't have it. Some of the most interesting plots involve a character who has power in one arena up against a character who has power in another arena, and both characters are caught in the same crucible. We will deal with the crucible in its own chapter. When planning your story, it is important to remember that small clashes result in stories that seem relatively trivial. Larger clashes resonate for the reader. Ask yourself these questions. Does the conflict you are working on lead to profound unhappiness, injury, or death? Or is the conflict over an object that is exceedingly valuable to the main character? Is the conflict over an important life decision, to move far away, to change one's career, to leave for another partner, to follow a hazardous opportunity, to avoid intolerable circumstances? Ask yourself, will the clash between your protagonist and your antagonist seem inevitable to the reader? Have you avoided coincidence as the cause of their clash? Will the clash take place in a highly visible environment so that the reader will see the action? If you have some concern about the intensity of your plot, ask yourself, does the conflict you've invented involve the best possible thing that could happen to your protagonist? Is what happens a surprise to anyone? Can you make it surprising by setting up an action and then showing the opposite of what your reader is likely to expect? Would the conflict you have described result in a verbal or physical struggle? Would that struggle call for strong scenes in which your characters clash in an exciting way? Remember, your book is told in scenes, each one of which should produce an exciting reaction in the reader. If any scene seems not yet exciting enough, think of introducing a new character into it, which always generates possibilities for conflict, especially if the new character has something important at stake in what is happening in that scene. If you get stuck, there's another device some writers use. Think of the worst thing that could possibly happen to you right now. Don't censor. A layman instinctively covers up. A writer disciplines himself to uncover. Now, think of your very best friend. Conjure up a picture of him or her in your mind. Remember the good times with your best friend. What is the worst thing that could happen to him or her at this very moment? It has to be something different from the worst thing you imagined happening to you. It should be linked to your friend's character, ambitions, or desire. Now imagine the same worst thing happening not to your best friend, but to the character in your story. Would that create a suitable obstacle in the plot you are developing? The protagonist's biggest obstacle is usually the antagonist and what he does. But there can be numerous other obstacles that will thwart the protagonist on the way to achieving his goal, including, perhaps, what you imagined happening to your friend.